Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, our review roundup contains Poor Behavior at the Duke on 42nd Street, Sunday in the Park with George at the Signature in Virginia, Things We Do for Love at Westport Country Playhouse, the Amos Musical Theater production of Red Eye of Love, and the Movie of Oklahoma, which is playing at the AFI in Silver Spring, Maryland. That plus news. Please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios This Week on Broadway for Monday, September 1st, 2014. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Kritzerland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Hello, Peter.
Good evening.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening.
So the three of us back together once again. It's September 1st. It's the fall, right?
Isn't that? Doesn't feel it.
Doesn't feel it.
I'm not going to complain. It's been a great summer.
Absolutely. Well, also,
otherwise,
I guess it's not technically fall, so that's
that's
a comfort.
22nd or something like
21st,
that?
21st, yeah.
21st, 22nd, yeah, something like that. The kids remind me. So I just wanted to let the listeners know that we had a change on the BroadwayRadio.com website, and some of you may notice a little change in it. We limited our past episodes on the feed where you automatically download This Week on Broadway on iTunes or other places to the last five episodes rather than the last, we had 300 and some odd episodes. And the 300 some odd episodes was causing a server choke on our side because we've been fortunate enough to be very successful. And having 50,000 some odd people check our feed every hour was killing the server. So we limited it back to five, and it's much more happy. But if you do want to get old episodes of This Week on Broadway, you can always go to the website, BroadwayRadio.com, and everything will always be there. Or if you have a special question or problem, please email me at james@broadwayradio.com. So let's move on. So, Peter, you got a chance to see Poor Behavior at the Duke, which is a Primary Stages production. Michael talked about it a few weeks before. Why don't you tell us what you thought about it?
It's a very controversial play. I mean, I don't recall hearing so many raves and pans of a show in recent months as much as this one. But
oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh. You had a different experience. People have said.
I actually the only I guess I read one review that was very negative, and that's the only feedback I've gotten other than my own.
I liked a good deal of it. I will admit that the end of the first scene struck me as a little unconvincing. The people didn't do what I expected them to, but I'm not going to give that away. What I am going to do is tell the setup. We're in a nice little country house, and the couple that own the country house, that's Ella and Peter, decide to have some friends in for the weekend. Won't that be fun? No, it won't. It won't be fun at all, I'm sorry to say. And that's the thrust of the play, because Ian and his wife Maureen are having a lot of issues, but it spills over. The problem is when a couple starts having problems, it's not long before the other couple starts questioning their own relationship. And that happens here to a good degree. At the beginning of the play, we do see that Ian and Ella hate each other. They have completely different ideologies. They don't agree on anything. Every time that they bring up a new point in an argument, it just escalates the argument to that much of a degree. More, well, of course, as Sheldon Harnick taught us in The Apple Tree, love and hate do go hand in hand, and that will be something that becomes an issue in Poor Behavior before all is said and done. In a way, it's a cautionary tale about if you have a beach house or a summer house, you know, be careful who you invite over. It could turn out to be pretty disastrous because they're there for the weekend. And how do you get rid of people when you promise them a weekend? It even comes to the point when they say, get out. They don't even leave. I mean, it's very, very difficult. The other thing that's interesting is that it is also a play that indicates, boy, if you're married, you are vulnerable. I mean, you think of the people you've missed. You think about the sexual situations you didn't have. And everybody becomes a strange type of contender because you're just in the marital rut, so to speak. Now, of course, there are many, 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 many happy marriages. And I don't mean to say this across the board, but there certainly are people I've known over the years who have this experience that I see Ella and Peter and Ian and Maureen have. So I think there's truth in this play. Not long on plot. I also question why, when you invite people for the weekend, there's no food in the house. There's a big deal made of that, how they don't have any food. Don't you go out and shop before you invite people over? I mean, you know, I certainly would. So I think that's a bit of a problem as well. Nicely acted, indeed. No problem at all. Heidi Ann Brewster is Maureen, and she's really a human train wreck. No question about that. Katie Kreisler, that's not spelled like the car, but Kreisler, is Ella, and she's a woman who's really trying very hard to be fair and good and honorable and true, and she does that very well while also struggling with other demons. Ian has that nice male chauvinist pig attitude that I'm sure that the playwright wanted. He is played by somebody you might know from TV, Brian Avers. I understand he's on a series called NCIS. But that leaves us with Peter. And, you know, this is a tough role because he's the blandest character. That's the writer's choice. I mean, she doesn't want him to be exciting because, of course, Ian's supposed to be the exciting bad boy while Peter's the good boy. And, you know, what happens when that? Well, I think you're figuring it out. Jeff Beal plays him, and he does it very, very nicely. A lot of truth in this play, a lot of conflict, no question about that. Whether or not you buy it all is the ultimate thing. I did.
Yeah, interesting. I think there. I agree that there's a lot of truth in it, but to me, there were the no food in the house was only one example of several things that didn't make any sense and that kept taking me out of it. Also, as I mentioned, Peter, could you think of any reason why Ian was Irish? I mean, as I said, I mean, there's no reason not for him not to be, but I kept wondering if it was supposed to make some point. And he does go on about Americans on more than one occasion, but
yes. Well, it does come up in the play that Maureen has to wonder if he married her just to get the green card. That actually is stated. So that may be one of the reasons why the playwright decided to put in that element. Because, you know, if that happens, you know, you always have to wonder, does he love me or does he love the chance to become an American and not have to leave the country? So I think that might be the motivation for that.
Yeah, I see.
Maybe. You know, well, next time we see Teresa, we'll ask her. So, it's a very good production. It always intrigued me, I thought it was definitely worth my time and energy. So, I wish it well. I bet it gets a lot of productions in regional theater in the next few years.
She, I think one of her strengths has always been that she's able to write very good dialogue.
Yeah.
I don't know if anyone would really argue otherwise. I think the actual dialogue is very, very good. It's just, to me, there's always kind of over the top things and credulity straining things in her plays that keep taking me out of them. So it's too bad because I do think it's a great talent to be able to write dialogue like that.
Mm, I'll say.
All right. So it's Poor Behavior at the Duke, which is being brought to us by Primary Stages, who is down at the Duke, as we mentioned a couple weeks ago, for this season.
Yes. We'll see if they continue there. Because they had, as we mentioned, they had been at 59 East 59th Street for several years. And before we started recording, Peter and I were speculating if they moved just because it 59 East 59 is so far away from the theater district, or if, you know, if there are other reasons behind that.
Each space is equally commodious, by the way. both very yeah. nice theaters.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, so Michael, you got down to the Signature Theater to see Sunday in the Park with George. So tell us, what'd you think about it?
Well, it was a very strong production overall. I had some caveats, which I'll get into, but certainly the cast was quite excellent. I know that you had Claiborne Elder, who played George, on the podcast last week, and he and Bryn O'Malley as Dot were really, really excellent. Although they both seemed a little vocally tired on the night I went, and they both had very occasional pitch problems. I saw it on a Saturday night, so they would have done a Saturday matinee, Saturday evening. And I'm sorry, Friday evening, Saturday matinee, and Saturday evening. But then I noticed, actually, on the theater schedule that they also were doing two on Sunday. So I don't know if seeing it on Sunday evening would have been the best choice in the world. But I don't want to overstate it. It was just occasional. They seemed a little tired. They were both acting-wise and singing-wise really excellent overall. And the entire cast... much of which, or most of which, is made up of, I guess, DC regulars. Everyone was excellent, but I want to signal out Donald Migliaccio, who's really a mainstay of DC theater. She played the old lady, and she had some really wonderful moments. And this fellow named Paul Scanlon, and also... Gregory Mayhew, who I saw in 1776 at Ford's Theater. He was the soldier and Alex. And then there was this guy. I'm sorry, I just can't find it on the page here. Paul Scanlon was the boatman in Act 1, and then in Act 2, he's Dennis, who winds up being George's assistant, kind of in Act 2, the modern-day George. And he really was really excellent, because the characters were so different, and he made them so different that I almost – it took me a while to realize it was the same actor. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really about the highest praise you can give. Mm-hmm. Musically, the production was excellent, although the orchestra was fairly small. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 pieces. It sounded excellent, and the sound – amplification was also very, very good, so that helped. The balance between the singers and the orchestra was wonderful, and the quality of the sound was very good. And it put to shame, I still can't quite believe that the Roundabout Theater got away with the size orchestra, quote unquote orchestra, that they had when they did that otherwise excellent production of Sunday in the Park that they brought over from London. That was pitiful, and so was the most recent the revival of A Little Night Music that was on Broadway, and that wasn't the Roundabout, but that was, you know, both of those I think it was almost criminal, and I honestly don't think that either one of those companies productions would have gotten away with it if people in general were more sensitive to things like orchestra size. I don't recall a huge hue and cry over that, and there should have been, because that was just terrible. But no, at the Signature in Arlington, you're going to hear a really nice statement of the score by the orchestra and the singers. It was, as I say, very strong overall. The pacing, the day I went in Act One, I noticed was really a little off. I thought it was quite slow. The show was 2 hours and 45 minutes long with the intermission, which seems a little long to me. But I realize that those kind of things can vary greatly from one day to the next. So hopefully it happened the night I saw it. This is interesting because when Claiborne was on the podcast, he mentioned that the concept of the production was that presumably the concept of the director, Matthew Gardner, was that the entire thing took place in George's studio. Honestly, I felt that I think maybe the reason they came up with that concept was because they couldn't think of an easy way to get the furniture off stage. Because I'm pretty sure that the signature, that their space has been slightly different configurations for the several things that I've seen there. But I think it's always a sort of modified three-quarter thrust, but a very shallow thrust. The stage is wide, but it only comes out into the audience not very, I don't know, maybe like 10 feet or less. So it's not the usual three-quarter thrust kind of setup. And they just really, I don't know how they would have gotten the furniture off from the studio, even if they wanted to. But that I didn't really like that because it kept taking me out of it. There would be references to scenes that are obviously supposed to be taking place in the park, and then suddenly someone would go sit on a table that had art supplies on it, and I didn't specifically really like that. Another thing is. This is so interesting. There are fair amounts of people sitting on either side of this very shallow thrust, and I'm sure that the entire point of the end of Act One is lost on all of those people, because if you're looking at the stage from the extreme sides, the very idea of this recreating the painting Sunday afternoon on the island of La Grande Chatte would be lost on you because you're just seeing people from the sides. Now, I suppose it's you know, true that people who were sitting on the extreme sides of the orchestra for the Broadway production also didn't have an ideal view of that, and the people who were slightly to the sides didn't have as good a view of it as the people sitting dead center. But it did seem to, the fact that it was a three-quarter thrust setup seemed to exacerbate the problem. So in that sense, it probably wasn't the best choice to do in that theater if they were going to maintain the three-quarter thrust. But I was sitting in the middle, so so it wasn't an issue for me. It was just something I was conscious of, that it would be a problem for the people on the sides. Other than that, really very strong production. They really do wonderful productions overall of the several that I've seen. I remember, I think I reported on Company last year, that was really very, very well done there. So if you're in the area, it's definitely worth the trip for Sunday in the Park with George at the Signature.
So will we be seeing a more in-depth discussion about this in the Sondheim Review?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay. Depending on you, Michael, to write it. That's what he meant.
Well, they have they do have people who cover regional shows for them, and I think that's probably taken care of as far as a review. So so I'm sure there will be coverage of it, but not by me.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So let's move a little bit forward here. The Things We Do for Love is a show that Peter saw at the Westport Country Playhouse this week, I believe. Peter, was it?
last weekend.
Last weekend?
Michael, you think that the people in at Signature had problems seeing things? No. All right. Now, here's the story of the things we do for love. An Alan Ayckbourn play, and if you know it's Alan Ayckbourn, well, then there's got to be a gimmick somewhere in the show, right? I mean, that's his policy. Here the gimmick is the stage that we usually see whenever we go to see any type of show set in a house or an apartment represents one level of the house. There is an upstairs and there's a downstairs. And the downstairs is literally in the orchestra pit. And as a result, if you're not in the first few rows, you ain't seeing nothing. I'm telling you, it was amazing. Okay, at intermission, people say, can you see anything? I can't see. Now, I'll admit, very little happens down there. But the point is, whenever anything does happen down there, you assume you're missing a lot, but you're not. Okay. Then what he does up above, he has decided to do something very much, if you remember the Tommy Tune musical, A Day in Hollywood, A Night in the Ukraine. Well, A Day in Hollywood, they had a little strip where you only saw people's feet. And the song was called Famous Feet because, indeed, that's what you saw. You saw red ruby slippers, and so you know who that was, that type of thing. Well, so here you mostly only see feet, but occasionally John Chillinger has directed it so the people are crawling on their knees, that type of thing. But the other problem is that Mr. Tillinger decided to put a bed on extreme stage left, and that bed is going to be used before all is said and done this play, believe me. And there I was sitting in D2, and I could just see what was going on. My girlfriend sitting next to me in D4 just could see a little less, but something. But there were like four or five seats, you know, next to her. I don't know why this bed couldn't be put in the middle of the room. Why not? Why does the bed have to be to the side? That way everybody could have seen at least that. So I think there was really a problem there, and this was not the ideal space for this show under the circumstances, especially after you use the orchestra pit. So, all right. So what's the play about? Well, Things We Do for Love is about a single woman who's very happy being single. That's it. She's been single all her life. Everything's great. Couldn't be better. Owns a house, you know, and so she's the landlord, and she rents the upstairs, downstairs apartment. And what she's going to do now is rent to her dear old friend, Nikki. It's established they're dear old friends, but it's also established they haven't seen each other for 11 years. So I guess what Ayckbourn is saying is we have these people who we always talk about being our wonderful friends, and how wonderful are they if indeed we don't see them for that long a time. Of course, it could be effectively argued that many people do have wonderful relationship people and they don't get around to seeing each other, but this seemed to be neglect rather than inconvenience. So that was a bit of a surprise. Anyway, Nikki has a new boyfriend, a fiancé. Won't be long before they're getting married. The thing is, they're waiting for the house to be finished, and that's why they're renting from Barbara. So it seems the play is going to be about the fact that Barbara and the new inamorata here, Hamish is his name, hate each other. We're getting a lot of hate in this podcast, aren't we? Hate each other. I mean, they, again, just like the Rebeck play, one thing escalates just as it seemed, and this poor Nikki trying to calm everybody down. And no sooner is something calmed down than somebody says something that infuriates the other, and it goes on like that. So for a while there, you think, oh, this is really good. What happens when your friend has fallen in love with somebody that you can't stand? And then I thought, well, you know, but if they only see each other every 11 years, I mean, that's not so big a deal. Yes, they're going to be living together for a while. But we do get the impression that this is a separate way to get up there. And, you know, so they don't even have to run into each other. Well, as it turns out, one has to wonder if Miss Rebeck went to see Things We Do for Love in London in 1997, because much the same thing happens as happens in Poor Behavior. I'm only kidding, of course. Frankly, both of them have come up with ideas that have been done a million times before. But there is a similarity there, and it's much too long. 2 hours and 45 minutes is just too long for a comedy. It just is, especially when you don't have much to say. It's funny, you know, because Alan Ayckbourn has often been called the British Neil Simon. And I was reminded of the famous review that Walter Kerr wrote for the Star Spangled Girl, a Neil Simon play from 66, in which he said Neil Simon didn't have an idea for a play this year, but he wrote one anyway. And it's pretty, it almost seems that way with Alan Ayckbourn, who must have felt, I got to keep on writing these things. You know, I mean, people are expecting them, and it's what I do. I don't know how to shut it off. So, but it really didn't have a very interesting plot. And so it suffered for that. When you don't have an interesting plot, but you do have 2 hours and 45 minutes, that's a tough thing on an audience, especially when you can't see a lot of the show. So so I think we have to chalk this one up as not one of the greater triumphs that has been offered at the Westport Country Playhouse. They, the artistic director, Mark Lamos, that wonderful actor from Longtime Companion, if you know that movie, who has certainly made a name for himself in Connecticut. Here he is at Westport now, and he said before the show that next year they're doing Bedroom Farce. So they seem to have a real commitment to Ayckbourn. He says, you know, our patrons love it. They like this one a bit. I don't know if they loved it, but I think they'll have better luck next year with Bedroom Farce because that's a better play. However, you know, it was very, very nicely acted. Geneva Carr, who we've seen here in New York, was terrific as Barbara. And Michael Mastro was wonderful as Gilbert. Now, the thing about Gilbert, he's the one who lives down below. He's a handyman, and he is desperately in love with Barbara. Oh, how he loves her. But, of course, she has made it very clear, that she's single and that's it, and he accepts that. So you can imagine what happens when she takes up with somebody else, you know, because it's one thing to say, well, she's just not interested in anybody. But when he finds out she is interested in somebody, well, then it ceases to be her problem and it becomes his problem. So, but like the Rebeck play, I mean, there's also a bit of indication here that sex is like those famous oil filter ads that we used to have in the 70s, where the guy was fixing the oil filter and used to turn to us and warn us that we should get our oil filters replaced before they get lousy, because you can pay me now or pay me later, you know, and that's what sex is, too. You can pay me now or you can pay me. Sex demands payment somewhere along the line, and you have to pay now or later. So, I wish it was shorter. I wish he had kept with the idea of these two people hating each other. I think that would have been funnier. But because Michael Mastro and Geneva Carr were so good, and the other two were good, too, it certainly was a tolerable evening.
That's interesting about the sidelines. I have to say, it is kind of surprising to me and a little annoying, more than a little annoying, when professional directors make blunders like that, which really should not be made by professional directors. You know, every now and then you'll see a show where you really think, in terms of that specifically, sidelines, did this person only sit,
sure,
you know, in center orchestra? Right. And really, I mean, I don't know. I mean, gosh, I tried to be conscious of that when I was directing community theater. I don't think it's too much to ask.
No, I guess it does. I wonder what the real reason is why they don't go all around the house and say, uh-oh. Is it because they can't be bothered? Is it because they feel those are the cheap seats? I hope not, too. Is it simply there's no time, you know, to do that as they perceive it. But it is a responsibility of a director to do that.
Yes.
And really, but I mean, the solution is so simple in the case of that bed.
Right.
I mean, where is it written that every bed has to be against the wall of an apartment, the right-hand wall? Why must that be? I mean, why can't it be in the center of the room? What's the problem?
Exactly.
With the head, you know, so anyway, so that's a bit of a problem there. But at least the production, in terms of the acting, was very nicely conceived and delivered. So I was happy with that.
Peter, you also got a chance to see the Maas Musical Theater's production of Red Eye of Love. I feel a love theme here. So tell us about that production.
Well, this is another show where we have a triangle. I mean, what's it like when you're a poor, impoverished guy, and there's also a guy who owns a meat factory who's vying for your girl? I don't know how much more has to be said, but this is an absurdist musical, and as a result, every now and then a line will come across that makes deliciously and I mean that, no sense, and you just laugh because it's so outrageously, the point of view is so skewered. Based on Arnold Weinstein's play from back in the 60s, that was a moderate off-Broadway success, ran 6 months or so. I don't know that this one will, the musical version, though I will say that this Sam Davis, wow, he's the real thing as a composer. And this score is definitely worth hearing. And if there's a CD made, I think it will rule my CD player for many a moon to come. Granted, what he's doing is he's written a pastiche score. That may be why I like it, because it deals with the early part of the 20th century and the middle of the 20th century. I certainly thought he really grasped it very, very well. But, you know, it's funny. They bring out these enormous slabs of meat, you know, and I was reminded of the Betty Blue Eyes, which is also about meat. And, you know, there's something inherently disgusting about meat. And believe me, I'm no vegetarian. But, I mean, the thing is, you know, when you just the idea of so much meat on stage, even though, of course, it isn't meat. But, you know, there's I was reminded of Strike Up the Band, a musical from the 20s and 30s, because originally when it was conceived, it was all about cheese. And they closed out of town, and then they said, well, let's make it about chocolate. Well, I wish that this guy owned a chocolate factory and not a meat factory. I think that would have been much more delicious. But anyway, Josh Grizzetti is the guy, and he's quite, quite good. Well, you know that. Josh Grizzetti's always good. The gentleman who became a big sensation by playing David Kolowitz, the actor, in the Enter Laughing musical that was at the York Theater for an extended period of time. But also wonderful beyond belief is Ali Mawzy, who is just terrific playing this girl who doesn't know what to do with her life and how to proceed. She thinks she does, and then she doesn't. And I mean, it's all over the place. But what a performance. She is absolutely delicious, delightful, terrifically attractive, and just really quite wonderful. Kevin Parisot is a little colorless, but it's always hard with a part like that where you're the guy that we're not supposed to be rooting for. So we don't really much care about him. We really want the two young lovers to get together instead of the big money man winning because he's got a lot of money. But two pianos play the score. I wish they were at a smaller theater. They're at the DiCapo, which is on East 76th Street. Mm. It's too modern a theater for this show, and it gets lost. There are some chorus people in the show, and they're very good, by the way. Every one of the chorus people are really, really good. But if they were at the Cherry Lane, I'm telling you, this show would be two times better because it needs to be intimate, and it does seem to get a little lost. But those who like traditional musical comedy, I think you should hear this music. I think you should hear this music. He's good, this Sam Davis. God love him. May he live to be 100.
Wow. So now I want to hear it. Right. So we'll have to see. Does anybody know anybody at maybe Masterworks Broadway or somebody that could talk to somebody and get this recorded?
I don't know anybody at Masterworks Broadway.
Maybe we can talk to Bruce Kimmel.
Why not?
We'll see. And PS Classics and Chickaboom and all of them get together and, you know, throw a piece in and get this, you know. Hey, has anybody, Peter, do any of the old cast recordings, were they ever done in conjunction with two labels?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. Conjunction. I'm sorry. No, I don't think so. I don't think two labels have ever said, look, we'll put up half the money and you put up half the money. That's what you mean. I mean, there have been many, many cast albums, for example, like The Golden Apple, which started off on RCA Victor and later was released by Elektra. That's not what you meant. Yeah. I thought you did initially, but I don't know of any partnership that went on. Maybe there have been, but I can't think of one. Can you, Michael?
No, I don't think so. There were situations where, but that leads to the very interesting point that the most famous example I can think of is Call Me Madam, which was Ethel Merman made a recording of songs from the show, but she was under contract to Decca, and the cast album, the rights, RCA had purchased the rights to put out the cast album, so they put out the album with all of the cast except for Ethel Merman, and Dinah Shore, of all people, sang Merman's role. So that was a that was quite an anomaly. Then there's the film of Porgy and Bess, which God knows that had so many problems, that movie. Mm-hmm. And the soundtrack recording was put out by Columbia, but Sammy Davis Jr. was under contract to another label, so he's not on it. It's Cab Calloway. That didn't happen very often anyway, and I don't
know. No, but it's funny. I mentioned this in my upcoming book about the 63-64 season, because Barbara Streisand was and is signed to Columbia, now Sony, and Capitol had already invested in the show. So as a result, Capitol was going to get the original cast album, and who would have recorded if that practice had been in effect? We'd have Funny Girl with what? Nancy Wilson? Cilla Black? Mrs. Miller? I don't know. It's just an interesting thing. I mean, imagine a Funny Girl album without Barbara Streisand. Of course, you can say, well, we have one with Diana Ross. I mean, you know, and that's true. There is a Diana Ross and the Supremes Funny Girl, which is worth hearing for its own sake. You shouldn't go through life without hearing that album. By the way, this does not mean to imply it's good. I'm only saying you should definitely hear this album. It's a fascinating way to spend time. So, but no, I don't think too. It's an interesting idea though, James. You know, joining forces. We don't have the money. You don't have the money. But together we do have the money. So why don't we do it? You know, it's. I was just thinking tonight about the show Platinum back in the late 70s that was on Broadway. It certainly didn't go platinum as a cast album because there was no cast album made. These get fewer and fewer. So even as good as I think the music is for Red Eye of Love, it's certainly no Lead Pipe Cinch that this is going to be a cast album on our shelves, next to Redhead. I can't predict that.
All right. So a cast album that I think did pretty well was that Oklahoma cast album. And
that's why they're all happening. Yeah.
And Michael got a chance to see the film version of Oklahoma. Where was it while you were down in Washington? Michael?
Yes, in Silver Spring, Maryland, which is very close to Washington, D.C. You could just take the metro there. There is an AFI theater, American Film Institute. I believe it's only one of two in the entire country, the other one being in L.A. I tell you, if I lived down there, I would be there at this movie theater three times a week. They have so many fantastic programs. Oklahoma, this is the digital restoration of the Todd Ayo version of the film Oklahoma, which, as I'm sure many of our listeners know, there are actually two entire separate films of Oklahoma because it was shot in the Todd Ayo process, which was a 65-70 millimeter process, or even larger than that. But it was so new that when they filmed it, they didn't think that they knew how to convert it to 35 millimeter. So there are actually two different takes of every scene. The recordings of the songs are the same in both cases, but the dialogue and the actual film that you're seeing is two different takes for every single shot of the entire film, for the CinemaScope version and the Todd Ayo version. And there are that off the top of my head, there are at least two other movies like that without as much publicity about it. One is Brigadoon, and the other is Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. So that was just an anomaly of the widescreen process and technology going so quickly and people not knowing what they were, you know, what they could do and what they couldn't do. But anyway, this was part of a 70 millimeter festival. They were also showing Around the World in 80 Days, which is another Todd Ayo film, and they were showing several others. And they were showing an Alec Guinness festival that had everything from Star Wars to The Bridge on the River Kwai to Lawrence of Arabia. So it's a fantastic place. If you ever are in the D.C. area, check out the program for the AFI Theater in Silver Spring, Maryland. But anyway, the film of Oklahoma is quite extraordinary because it's so perfectly cast and so faithful to the show. while also being extremely cinematic, as brilliantly directed by Fred Zinnemann. Gordon McCrae and Shirley Jones are perfection as the two leads. Charlotte Greenwood, phenomenal as Aunt Eller. Gloria Graham as Ado Annie. Rod Steiger, of all people, as Judd. And one of the many great things about the film is that it has a few people who were in the original Broadway cast of the show, one of whom is Bambi Lynn, who I'm happy to say is still very much with us. And she was Dream Laurie. In the film, she's Dream Laurie. In the original production, she was just in the ensemble of the dancers, Agnes DeMille's dancers. So that was an upgrade for her, definitely. And the other person from the original cast is Mark Platt, who was Dream Curly in the original. And in the film, he's just one of the dancers. And he doesn't come into the film until about halfway through, or more than halfway through, the Farmer and the Cowman number. And it took me a while to figure out that that's probably because he was filming Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, in which he's one of the brothers. But anyway, he was a great dancer, great Agnes DeMille dancer, great dancer all around. And he, I just looked him up, he only died very recently, March 29th of this year, at over 100 years old. So that film, as I said, aside from everything else that's great about it, how wonderfully it's filmed and how faithful it is, it's so fantastic and historical to have people like that in it.
Of course, 2 years is a long time, but 2 years ago, Bambi Lynn did present a Theatre World Award, and she was still in lovely shape then, and I hope that she still is as we speak. But it was very nice because she was one of our first class members in 1945. And so we're very glad that she came and presented an award. She was delightful, and we wish her well as we speak tonight.
That's wonderful.
So if you are in the Silver Springs area, or you get down to Sunday in the Park, maybe you should check out the AFI Theater in Silver Spring, Maryland. So other things in the news this week, we had two notable passings that we should mention for just a bit. Broadway veteran Victoria Mallory passed away. Peter, what did you think about Victoria?
Well, I was at the very, very, very first performance ever of A Little Night Music on January 20th, 1973 at the Colonial Theater in Boston, and she was already giving a performance. You'd never know that she didn't have all that much experience. And I had the pleasure of speaking to her not that long ago when she was doing a show with Kurt Peterson she was just lovely, and she got such a fondness in her eye when she was talking about the fact that Hal Prince said to her when she was in Follies that indeed he had her in mind for another part. She had pancreatic cancer, and it was diagnosed not that long ago, and unfortunately that's one of the most deadly diseases. You don't have much time left when you've been diagnosed with that, and the thing is that she bravely decided, I'm going to enjoy my time. I am not going to spend it going from hospital to hospital having treatment when I know it's not going to work. I'm just going to rest comfortably. I'm going to enjoy my life such as it is, and that's a better way to spend my time. And my hat's off to her for making that courageous decision, knowing that she was living without hope, but knowing that she was living as opposed to just existing, waiting for the doctor to come in and tell her that nothing was working anyway. So I do applaud her, and I wish she had done more. She wound up running off with her Henrik in the show, ironically enough. She was Anne, and you know, in Night Music, Anne runs off with Henrik. Well, so did she, Mark Lambert. And so our condolences go out to him, and of course, Rebecca Mallory.
Ramona.
Sorry, thank you. Yeah. Ramona, of course, showed up in A Little Night Music, the revival, not that long ago. So I'm sure that brought her mother a great deal of happiness. And I'm glad that it worked out as well as did there. So she did have many highs in her life. And while it's always sad to say goodbye to somebody again, I'm really very impressed with the way she handled it.
Yes, and also so great that it, just 2 years ago she got to do that fantastic show with Kurt Peterson. I think he sort of wooed her to sort of come back, and she died just a few days ago at 64. So she was 62 then, but her voice was in fantastic shape. They did the show that they did was called When Everything Was Possible, sort of inspired by, well, at least the title of Ted Chapin's book on the history of Follies, that really great book on the making of Follies, the creation of Follies. But Kurt and Victoria, to make a long story short, they met, they both went to AMDA, and I guess they knew each other there. And then they were both cast, Victoria first, and then Kurt in the revival of West Side Story that was done at what was then the New York State Theater when the Music Theater of Lincoln Center was functioning there with Richard Rodgers as the producing director. And they played Tony and Maria. And then, let's see, then in Follies, they were, Kurt was young Ben, and Victoria was young Heidi, although apparently that part was added somewhat later. So that was something that she got to do that was not originally supposed to really be in it. And then, Night Music, you know, really, I put on both of those albums the past couple of days just in tribute to her. And she had the most natural, sounding soprano voice. I think it there was nothing fake about it. It was very much, you know, up to the demands of both of those roles, and I would say quasi operatic, but just a really beautiful natural quality. Didn't sound trained in a bad sense. Didn't sound hooty or really covered. So that's something that she really had going for her, and so perfect for especially for the role of Anne in Night Music, who's supposed to be this innocent young thing. Really a definitive, I would say, well, I would say a definitive portrayal, although she, since her daughter then wound up doing it, maybe she might not like that word so much. But anyway, I'm so glad that she did have that triumph 2 years ago with Kurt Russell, and so sorry that this cancer arose and that she's gone now.
So another Broadway community member, Angelo Del Rossi, who is the longtime executive producer at the Paper Mill Playhouse, passed away. Peter, you must have known Angelo from your longtime coverage of the Paper Mill.
Yeah, indeed. Quite a gentleman, no question about that. And he certainly made the Paper Mill at one time the most successful theater in the country in terms of subscriptions. Nobody had a bigger subscription base. 40,000 people were signing up every year. So you must be doing something right. Now, a lot of people say, well, yeah, but they all died off. Still, when they were alive, they didn't have to subscribe there after all. There are other things they could have done with their time and money, but they chose to go there. And there was a time when that theater used to have productions that would knock your eyes out. They were just so magnificent. And so that's Angelo making that happen for all those years. And I remember his telling me some years ago that he was really looking to retire, that he had certainly been there since the 60s in one capacity or another. And but he knew what Millburn, New Jersey wanted, and he really did a very nice job of keeping that theater alive, especially after the famous fire that occurred there, when it could have been very easy that was the end of it. But he was determined that they were going to rebuild, and they certainly built a facility that, from what I'm told, I never saw the old place, I have to admit. But
Really?
No, never did.
Oh, yeah, I was in it once. I was in it like around 1974 or 75 to see Ann Miller in Anything Goes.
Can blame you. Anyway, I'm told it was like the term I always hear, and you can verify this or not, a shoebox, that it was long and narrow. Does that ring a bell to you?
To be honest, I don't have a whole lot of memory of it. I seem to remember this, the outside of it being very, very rustic and old, you know, an old fashioned, like something like the Cape Playhouse or, you know.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah, I know the Cape Playhouse. So, but anyway, you know, we have to say that that theater would not be around today had it not had that wonderful boom growth that Angelo Del Rossi was totally responsible for.
Aside from his accomplishments there, which were great, he always struck me as such a classy guy.
I agree.
Yeah, just something so I can't, that's the best word I can think of. It's very classy, very, you know, professional and very friendly and always meticulously dressed. And
you know, I was just going to say, as my mother would say, neat as a pin. Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Charlie Seidenberg was mentioning that Charlie, longtime press rep at Paper Mill, said that Angelo never took a bad picture. And I had to think about it because I thought about it. I was like, I've never seen him not look like a movie star.
Yeah,
you know?
that's a good point.
They had not too many years ago, I guess, was it in conjunction with the publication of that wonderful coffee table book about Paper Mill? They had an event at Sardi's. That was, I guess, the last. Well, maybe not the last time I saw Angelo. I think I might have seen him once or twice at the theater after that. But that was a really great day for him. It was wonderful to see him there at that event.
Yes, but you bring up a good point, and that is the fact that when he left, he left. I think he really wanted to rest on his laurels, and he did not want to take away any thunder from the new artistic director, Mark Hobie, who's done a very fine job, too. Don't misunderstand me. And I never saw Angelo on any opening nights after he retired. I think he wanted the theater to go on, and figured that by his being around, people would make inevitable comparisons and all that. So it was best that the theater move forward. Mm. So I believe, I could be wrong. I mean, this might have nothing to do with anything, but I do believe that was his motivation.
Yeah. Yeah. He was a very, very classy person. All right. We haven't seen or spoken to Peter and Michael consistently this summer, and one of the things that got by us is a story about Motown, where Motown is going to be closing on January 18th, 2015, and then Kevin McCullum, one of the producers, says it's going to reopen on Broadway in July 2016 at Anita Lander Theater to be announced. I thought this was interesting. So what do you think?
It is certainly interesting. From the vantage point, we don't hear this type of thing happening. Shows used to take off at the summer, you know, and I guess taking off at the winter makes a little more sense. Of course, the big speculation is, it's just a way of saying we're closing without having to run the embarrassment of the fact that we're closing, that we're promising to come back, just as like every show that closes out of town always says, yeah, we're working on it, we're going to come back, and then they never do. Or almost never do. So we'll have to wait and see, of course. But I will say that Kevin McCollum is, after all, one of our best producers. If he's ever told a fib, I've never caught him at it. So I don't think it's impossible, especially if it were this year. He'd certainly have no problem if it were right now getting into a theater, because certainly there are theaters available. I guess a lot of this will depend on what's running next year and if indeed there are theaters available. But I wouldn't, I'm not the least bit skeptical in the way that people are that, this is just good PR and we've seen the last of Motown. I'm not convinced of that at all. And I think it's entirely possible that it will be another stop on the tour.
Well, but also the salient point here is there was, and I forget his exact language, but there was some allusion to downsizing. Wasn't there?
Yes, that's right.
For based on the what's going to be done for the tour, and the thing that struck me about that immediately was there's so much doubling in that show as it is, because there's so many songs and so many characters. So it'll be interesting to see how that shakes down if that happens. It's going to be an even busier cast than it is now. Hello?
I'm here.
Yeah, I was talking into an empty mic.
Okay.
Sorry about that. I'm just very interested to see if it ever does reappear. I mean, we hear stories about that all the time. But then again, As Peter has said, never a word Kevin McCollum has ever said has not come true. You know,
yeah. Although I do wonder. I mean,
I have no idea what he's promised women along the way. But
no,
I mean,
that's true.
I'm just talking theatrically.
He's got a beautiful wife, though, doesn't he?
Sure does. Yeah.
But I mean, it is unusual to announce something so far in advance, and it's also I'm not exactly sure what the point is.
The other hand, Broadway has changed this way. I mean, there used to be a time when a show would announce a closing on Saturday, you know, or the last 2 weeks. And now shows announce, you know, 5 months in advance they're closing. So maybe this is just the next step in that evolution.
I think maybe Peter hit the nail on the head where this is the next stop on the tour. Mm-hmm. Because, I believe that road producers like to, when the show is checking in at their theater, also have a Broadway production running at the same time.
Oh, sure. No, absolutely. But I guess aside from everything else, it's just, does that mean, do you think that a theater is locked in or do
no,
they just,
no,
or
it says just, a Nederlander to be announced.
Right. So I guess they're assuming that there will be some theater available.
And many Nederlanders.
No, not as many as the Schubert, certainly.
Yeah.
More than Drew Jampson. So,
that's true.
They might be able to find. How long is Love Letters going to last? I mean, maybe they'll go there. I mean, that would be very scaled down if it went to the Atkinson. But I would like to think that Honeymoon in Vegas will still be running this time next year. I think it has an excellent chance to, certainly. So,
But what I meant was, on the one hand, I mean, they can't start selling tickets to the Broadway return now. And one might argue that if he hadn't said that it was coming back, that perhaps that might have boosted sales for the tour.
That's fair.
So it is interesting, and I'm not exactly sure what's gained by saying it's coming back a year. How long from now?
Yeah,
10 months. Yeah.
Yeah. But we'll see.
So we were off, and we didn't talk about this. Mr. Riedel had an article on August 22nd about the Schuberts intending to build a new theater. What do you think about that?
Great. Let's have it. You know, frankly, what I would rather see them do is buy the Hellinger. Yeah, I think that would be far more cost effective, wouldn't it? You already have a theater. They've kept it in good shape. But I don't mind a building going up on 8th Avenue between 45th and 46th. I'm a little embarrassed by that empty space. You know, that's our big street, 45th Street. And there's that empty space that looks like somebody's backyard. I mean, really, it's like a beautiful model who has a tooth missing right in the front of her smile. So I'd like to see something happen there. And there was once a theater there, too. So it's very sad that since it's reduced to nothing at the moment, that theater, whatever it was, I don't even know what it was called. I don't remember, but isn't still there. But I guess we'll get a new one. But I'm telling you, it's fine with me if they build the Times Square Church, that theater, and take over the Hellinger. That's fine with me. And I'm told the church has outgrown that space.
Yeah, I keep hearing that more and more often. They're apparently, I'm not sure that I knew this, but they're already holding the masses, telecasting them closed circuit.
Oh, yeah?
To other locations because they don't have enough seats in the Hellinger. But the thing, I can't believe I don't actually already know this. Isn't there already a building directly on top of the Hellinger?
Julie Stein used to have offices above there. I know that. Is that what you mean?
Well, all I meant is, and I guess it doesn't matter anyway, because as we know, air rights can be purchased, and not necessarily used on the top of the place them.
Yeah.
But all I meant was, although Riedel didn't specify this, I think it goes without saying that if a new theater is built on 45th, 46th Street in that vacant lot, that it would be at the base of some kind of a skyscraper, whether a hotel. Yeah. Uh-huh. So that would be part and parcel of it.
And then the other thing that got some play in our quiet end of August, not much happens in theater, so we look to what's going to happen in the future, is the I almost said premature reviews of Finding Neverland, but were they premature reviews? What do you think?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Do you know, Peter?
No, you mean the fact that
Brantley.
Yeah, and Mr. Gerard went to Cambridge and reviewed. Yeah, that's certainly something that never happened in the past. I don't know if this is the wave of the future or what, but...
Well, I remember I asked months ago about press tickets for it because I had been going to ART. I saw Glass Menagerie there and a few other things recently. And at the time, they said... because I asked for a specific date, but it was I didn't realize how long the preview period was going to be.
They said
you could come, but the press dates are until blah blah blah. And so it looked like they were going to give me tickets. Now I realize I'm not Ben Brantley, but I'm just not clear as to whether Brantley and Gerard were invited,
mm-hmm.
or if there was any attempt to ask them not to review it.
I thought I heard that Ben Brantley was asked not to and bought a ticket.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You heard that too?
Yeah.
James, that rings a bell to you?
Mm-hmm. All right. So. Well, that may be. I just wasn't sure. And I was thrown off by the fact that initially they said they were going to give me press tickets. I mean, And then also it was very interesting that on the day before the press opening in Boston, in Cambridge, that is when the announcement came that it would be coming to Broadway,
mm-hmm.
before the reviews, whether by New York outlets or just by the local Boston outlets. So that really was very interesting to me.
Many of our listeners may remember that I come from Boston originally, and as a result, I have a lot of friends there who have made many a phone call at 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, telling me what they thought of the show. And boy, all over the place, I've heard everything from the first act is a masterpiece to the first act is terrible. And of course, the second act, people are saying much the same thing. All right, not masterpiece, but anyway... A lot of people have told me that the score is quite, quite good and fits the show. While other people tell me it's so anachronistic, it has nothing to do with the period. I mean, so I'm telling you, when you got friends like mine, you don't know what to believe. So
that just makes me all the more. I mean, that's so fascinating. And, that whole anachronistic thing, I always come back to, Sideshow, among other things. There are many shows that are like that, and it bothers some people a lot more than it does others.
So there is another high profile show, The Last Ship, which is a Sting show that is playing out in Chicago right now. There was one number from it in previewed in the Tony Awards this year. It's very difficult to say, why did you go to ART and Cambridge and not go out to Chicago and review Sting's show? Or, this is a moving target, how they decide what to do, what they do. So anyway, I thought we'd bring it up. And if you are a listener and you are interested in telling us your opinion on that, you can go to BroadwayRadio.com and contact information for Peter, Michael, and me is there. Send us your thoughts on it. Many people every week do send us their thoughts, and we really appreciate all the input that you do give us. You can subscribe to these podcasts by going to BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. As I mentioned in the beginning of the show, we have changed our feed to only reflect the last 5 episodes of This Week on Broadway. But if you wanted to check us out in other ways, you can go to BroadwayRadio.com, and all of our episodes for the last 5 years, some almost coming up on 300 episodes, is there for you to download as well. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Good night.
Bye. Yes, indeed. Thank you.